If you were here a couple of weeks ago, you would have heard Ian preaching on how to overcome evil with good. And before Ian preached, I had a little bit of carpet time down here at the front with the children, and we were looking at some images of bad things and how or what good things we might use to overcome those bad things. And one of the images we had was this one. The first image that came up was of a fairly serious fire, and Ori rightly pointed out that if we were faced with a fire, we would call the fire brigade. Good thinking. But in his sermon, Overcoming Evil with Good, Ian said that it's very easy when faced with bad things to snap back or to repay bad things with bad things. And as fallen human beings, when we're presented with something, when we hear something, when we read something, we filter what we see, what is presented to us, through our own circumstances, through our own experiences. And so when we respond, we don't always respond to exactly what was presented to us. Because when somebody presents something to me, if I change it in my mind, I'm going to react differently. So we have to be a little careful, because it's very easy to make matters worse. So while we're waiting for the fire brigade to come, we reach for the nearest hose and find that it actually looks more like this. And the other thing that we reach for in these days of instant communication and marvellous technology is this. And there's that moment, isn't there? You've probably not experienced it, but I have. When you hear the sort of whoosh of an outgoing email and you suddenly think, oh gosh, what have I just done? It's very easy to do. And again, I don't know about you, but I've received emails and I've opened them, and while I'm reading it, another little message pops up saying, the sender of that email wants to recall it. But by that stage, it's all too late, isn't it? So we need to be careful which hose, or what the hose that we reach for is actually going to pour onto any fire that we may be facing. But today's reading, the first reading, gives us a blueprint as to how we should deal with any little fire, because we may come across a little plume of smoke from a smouldering ember or something. But if we don't treat it right, then it's very easy to make matters a lot worse. So looking at Matthew 15, it says, if your brother sin against you. Now, interestingly, the NRSV actually translate this, if another member of the church sin against you. So it happens within the best of Christian communities as well as in the world outside. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus says, if your brother sin against you. But I think, if we're honest, we know that it's really a matter of when, isn't it? Again, we're all human beings. It happens. And actually, if you look at the wider context of chapter 18, it's obvious that Jesus knows that really it is a matter of when, because the disciples have been asking him about who's the greatest, and they go on to ask him about how many times they should forgive their brother. So I think we can assume fairly safely that it is going to happen. So looking at verse 15 then, it gives us three steps as to what we should do. So the first step, go to your brother. Go to your brother. Now notice that is a command to the injured party, the person who has been upset. It's very easy, isn't it, when someone upsets you, you sort of sit there. But Jesus is clear. We must go. We must make the first move. Don't just sit there stewing. We need to acknowledge that there is a conflict, because often the person who has offended us meant no offense. They were just trying to be helpful, but we've responded, we've received it differently. So we must acknowledge the conflict. We must cool off first, because we don't want to do anything in anger. And then we take this first step. We approach our brother. How do we approach them? Still in verse 15, we approach them one-on-one. It's very easy to gather a gang of people who are going to back us up. But actually, if we spread the news of any conflict wider, again, it adds fuel to the fire. It makes the thing bigger. And we see it time and again in the world out there. We read about it in the papers, people who gather a crowd of people around them immediately. Whereas actually, if you go and see the person, just talk to them quietly, you can often resolve the issue. So we approach one-on-one. We discuss it between ourselves. And it's really important that we don't duck the confrontation. I don't know about you, but I don't like confrontation. I don't do confrontation well. But if someone comes to you and says, "Christopher, you seem a bit off. Are you all right?" And we're terribly British. We say, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine." There's a very wise and godly friend of ours who used to say that "fine" stands for fouled up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. And I love that, because so often when we say, "No, I'm fine," that actually is exactly what we mean. We mean that there is a real issue, but we can't vocalize it. And we need to be specific about whatever this issue is when we go to our brother who has caused us offense. Because, as I said, they, hopefully, didn't mean to cause offense. They've done it inadvertently. So you have to explain to them what's happened. So you need to tell them what you think, what you feel they have done. Might be you didn't listen to me, or I didn't feel that you valued my opinion, or maybe you've jumped to a conclusion, or I think you have jumped to a conclusion. It's maybe a better way of putting it, rather than telling them. So you need to tell them what, in your eyes, they've done. You need to explain how that's made you feel. Made you feel undervalued or unappreciated, whatever it may be. And then you need to explain to them as well what changes you want to see. So it might be a question of, you know, "I want you to work more closely with me on this." Or it might be, "I want you to take more of the lead in this." You need to explain to them what your expectations are, because they won't necessarily understand. Our reading today says, "Show him his fault." The original Greek actually says, "Convict him of his fault." So you've got to convince the person. So it's not a question just of saying, "I think you did this, therefore you're wrong." It's a question of, "This is what I perceive you did." And then you discuss it, and you come to a conclusion. You convince them. And in convincing somebody, it needs to be explained. So that goes back to the previous point of being specific. Convincing somebody, of course, also entails listening to them, because there are two sides to every story. And in our reading today, listening is mentioned four times in three verses. It's normally your brother listening to you or not listening to you, as the case may be. But it's a two-way process. It has to be. The first century Greek philosopher, and you'll have to excuse me if I mispronounce his name, Epictetus, said this: we have two ears, one mouth, which indicates that we should listen twice as much as we talk. A more modern rendition of that, perhaps, comes from Stephen Covey, the author of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, who said, most people do not listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply. So again, what we're doing as we listen to somebody's argument, we're not thinking to understand that argument, we're thinking how we can immediately counter it. And again, that's not going to be conducive to convincing anybody. We listen, as we listen, we prejudge. We get ready to enforce our own agenda. But as it says in Philippians, each of us should not look only to our own interests, but also to the interests of others. Because in any confrontation, it's not just us who are affected, it's other people as well. And particularly if we have a conflict within the church, it affects how the whole church operates, and it also affects people's perception of the church. Because if people see that we're arguing amongst ourselves, then they're going to think, call yourself a Christian. And they're not going to be interested in what we have, which is, let's face it, part of our mission. And why do we approach our brother in this way? Again, still in verse 15, to win him over. Note the wording, to win him over, not to win over him. There's a difference there. And if that fails, verse 16, we go to our brother with one or two witnesses. And this goes back to the laws from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 19:15 says, one witness is not enough to convict a man of any crime or offence he may have committed. The matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And again, these aren't henchmen, people who you know are going to back you up, but they are prayerful witnesses. Later on in the reading, when it says, when two or three are gathered together, these are the witnesses. So it's a prayerful thing. It's not just a beating over the head thing. So you go to them with two or three witnesses again to try and show them their fault, to convict them of their fault. And if that fails, then you open the proceedings up to the wider church, which particularly in olden times could almost act as a court, and you would hear the arguments, hear the discussions, and make a decision. And what if even that fails? Treat your brother as a Gentile or a tax collector. And we know how highly tax collectors were regarded in biblical times. They weren't even allowed into the temple. So we're talking here of excommunication. Now it sounds a little drastic, although canon law still allows for excommunication. Ian can't do it, but he can refer the matter to the bishop, and the bishop can do it. Hopefully it would never come to that. It may seem a little extreme, certainly. But if we're treating somebody as a tax inspector, or tax collector, rather, or a Gentile, They may be excommunicated, but what was Jesus' attitude towards Gentiles and tax collectors? He still loved them. And so in all of this, in all of these arguments, we must still love people, because that is the fulfillment of the law, as we hear in our second reading today. And in this process, if we look at verses 18, 19, Jesus says that he will be with us. We have to be careful with these verses because they contain certain promises that if they're taken out of context are quite dangerous. If anything that you agree on earth will be done in heaven. So if, I don't know, Teta and I agree that it would be a good plan to go and rob the bank, that doesn't really quite ring true, does it? And if we bind anything here, if we say on earth, that is wrong, that must not be done, Jesus says that it will be done in heaven. If we look at verse 18 in isolation. But we have to take these verses, all three together, 18, 19, and 20, because 18 and 19 are qualified by 20. If you look at it on your service sheet, he's gone through, I tell you the truth, again I tell you, and then here is the reason in verse 20, for when two or three come together in my name, there am I also. If Jesus isn't at the center of this whole process, then it's not going to work the way it's written here. So why do we go to these lengths? We're called upon to live at peace with each other. We have instruction here in Matthew 18 from Jesus on how to live at peace with each other. But we also do it because of our second reading, Romans 13, verse 8. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. It's very clear. So, next time you're looking for a hose, whatever it may be, just apply four tests, if I may suggest. Is what you're about to say true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it helpful? And if what you're about to say fails one of those tests, then maybe, just maybe, it's better left unsaid. So a prayer as we finish, a verse from Psalm 141, verse 3. Set a guard over my mouth, Lord. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Amen.